From the Sky News Centre at 5, there's anger over plans to cut fuel duty for just a few parts of the UK. The Treasury is asking Europe for permission to reduce duty by 5p in remote areas, such as the Shetland Islands, Inner and Outer Hebrides and the Isle of Scilly. It says people there generally pay higher prices, up to £1.61 a litre for unleaded and £1.68 for diesel. Motorists on the Isle of Wight, though, feel forgotten.
I think it's disgusting. It's far too high. I put in more money in my car every week.
I think it's disgraceful and one-sided. We ought to be on the streets demonstrating, but we haven't got the mentality, have we? It's not in us.
I think it's very unfair.
It's reported at least 30 civilians have been killed in Libya by government forces trying to retake a town near the capital. Earlier, pro-Gaddafi forces fired tear gas and live ammunition at protesters in Tripoli. This local doctor in Zawahiri, which has been bombarded by government forces, says he can't understand why the West isn't doing something.
Gaddafi is using anti-tank missiles against individuals, using air force against individuals in other parts of the country, and people are fed up with this. International community just watching us being slaughtered day and night.
Eyewitnesses have told a court about two children screaming for help as the car they were in began to sink into a river. Chris Grady denies murdering his five-year-old daughter Gabby and attempting to murder his six-year-old son Ryan in Evesham in Worcestershire in February last year. The May Day bank holiday in England and Wales could be moved to different days. One idea is to make it coincide with St George's Day in England and St David's Day in Wales. And Wales has voted in favour of increasing the powers of the Welsh Assembly. The devolved parliament wants to be able to make its own laws in areas like health and education. Finally, League One Plymouth Argyle have gone into administration. They've already been hit with the standard 10-point deduction. Staff and players are being asked to continue working without pay. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and if you tuned in the last hour for Red and Griff's extravaganza, they're temporarily on Mondays, rumoured to be back on Fridays soon. So, in the week, millionaire tax exile and chairman of Bristol City Football Club, Stephen Lansdowne, jetted in to see his gigantic Sainsbury's granted planning permission. We ask, what happened to democracy in the city where big money talks and local businesses don't seem to matter? I'm joined this week by Lib Dem councillor for Lochlea's, who is on that planning committee, Guy Portney. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, are we seeing democracy and revolution in Libya? Or is it the opening shots in World War III? Our aircraft carriers are gone. The Harriers and Nimrods have been scrapped. A local MP and Conservative Defence Secretary Liam Fox announces the loss of 11,000 jobs from our armed forces. Martin Summers will be explaining the turmoil in Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Middle East and North Africa. And we ask, might we soon need our armed forces like never before? And we test the rumours that a US company called VeriChip has developed a human microchip which they want to replace money if the global economy collapses. Plus, the latest on our environment from Mike Birkin and Friends of the Earth in the Southwest. That's in the second hour after six. Well, on to our review of this week's news in a minute, but first our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of freezing at 0 degrees Celsius, although some parts of the outlying parts of the city may get frozen. Probably the actual city itself won't, since it's around zero. And it will be dry. This weekend, highs of 9 Celsius, a dry weekend. Lovely, isn't it? But with plenty of sunshine, just like this evening, especially on Sunday. Some frost, though, overnight. Next week, highs 9 degrees Celsius, fairly dry week. Plenty of sunshine and frosty nights again through next week. Next weekend, that's the 12th and 13th of March, highs up to 10, fairly dry with sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests, and with me is Lib Dem councillor for Lochlea's, Guy Portney. Hi, Guy, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, good afternoon.
Now, first of all, the Barnsley by-election today. The Lib Dems lost their deposit. They were beaten into sixth place behind the UKIP and the BNP, and the Lib Dem candidate lost his deposit. Apparently the local candidate was being told about 50 times a day he was being called a traitor around Barnsley. So what do you think for the Lib Dems' hopes with this the fallout from this coalition at the moment?
I'm correct, aren't I? That was Eric Ilsley's seat.
Yes, that's right.
This is the corruption thing. It's unfortunate. Obviously, we didn't get the message across. It's very unfortunate, but I'm sure the Lib Dems of Barnsley will be fighting hard for next time.
Well, many Lib Dems are saying that actually you're not getting a very good deal for this coalition up in London. The Conservatives are just simply calling the shots, and Nick Clegg's been a bit weak.
I don't know about that. I think we've actually gotten a better deal than our share of the seats might even indicate. Stuff like the people premium and taking the first £10,000 everyone earns out of tax is a pretty good result, but at the end of the day, more people voted Tory than voted Lib Dem.
Don't you really care about the students, though? Because they're the voters of the future. They're the people of the future.
I absolutely care about the students of the future. It's one of the reasons we push so hard to make sure no one has to pay anything up front to go to university.
Are you happy about this coalition, then, with the Conservatives? Because it's certainly not a coalition here in Bristol, is it?
It's certainly not a coalition in Bristol. It's certainly not a coalition in Europe. This is a coalition of Tory and Lib Dem MPs. I don't know about happy. I think it was the right thing to do at the time, but it really, really stings sometimes, but that's the nature of coalition government.
But this today's by-election result really is quite worrying, isn't it? For many Lib Dems, they'll be looking at this, biting their nails, thinking, actually, looks like things could be really going down the tubes here.
It means we have to work harder.
Now, what about committees? Because as a city councillor, you're on several committees. What do Bristolians get when they vote for local politicians? Aren't you really just glorified debt managers?
No, you get the local councillors that you vote for. I mean, it's the vast majority of my work, to be honest, isn't in the council house. It's in Lochlea's. It's getting things like potholes fixed and streetlights fixed, protecting local green spaces, that sort of thing.
So why aren't the council officers and the councillors as a whole doing those things anyway? I mean, you sound to me like you're sort of a fire brigade management. You're going in there when things go wrong.
To an extent, it is part of that, but at the end of the day, we're elected for a reason. Council officers have to do their job according to the policies of the local council, often according to the policies of central government as well. So knowing who your elected representative is locally gives you someone that you can go to, who you know is accountable to you.
Okay, so what committees are you on? We'll talk about the planning in a minute, but sure. Which other committees?
Most of my main committee duties, to be honest, I'm chair of the licensing committee, which deals with things like alcohol licences and that sort of thing. I'm the vice chair of the Public Safety and Protection Committee, which deals with things like taxi drivers, some street vendors. I sit on the Development Control Committee for the city centre, which is planning. I also sit on Resources Scrutiny, which looks at the budget. I've just signed up for the Communications Working Group, which is looking at the way that the council sort of faces the city of Bristol and how we get the council's message to people and how we let the people respond to the council.
With the licensing, I think this is a big one for a lot of people, because especially if they've got bars or pubs near them that are causing a lot of noise at night, how does that all work?
For a very long time, well, certainly since the 2003 Licensing Act, the licensing regime and local authorities has been incredibly prescriptive. Central government wanted a tremendous amount of control over what local authorities could and couldn't do. That's all hopefully changing over the next sort of year or so. Basically, if anyone wants to open a pub or club near you, you absolutely have the right to object and to come in front of the licensing committee and explain why. What we can take into account is actually quite limited. But,
well, one of the things that, you know, quite often happens is a club or a pub opens and you didn't even know it was going to open. So what can you do? Anything retrospectively? Can you actually get someone's license taken away if they're causing a lot of racket at night?
Absolutely. If you can show a premises is causing crime, if it's causing public nuisance, if it's putting children in danger, if it's a risk to public safety, you absolutely have the right to get your local councillor to call that in for review.
The other thing, of course, is they were seeing a lot of pubs closing down, so they won't need their licences anymore. Why is that?
I suspect the kind of pubs that are closing down aren't the kind of pubs that are causing the problems. It's not usually, and this is really broad strokes, but it's not usually the local pubs that are scraping by that are causing the problems. It's the sort of bigger venues in the heart of town. But as you say, if you live next door to a local pub that makes your life a misery, then yeah, that's difficult. Often it's just about getting the compromise right.
Okay, and finally, what's your own personal background and why the Lib Dem Party and not another party?
Came to the Lib Dem Party. I want to see power given back to local people wherever that's at all possible. And when I first encountered the Lib Dems in Bristol, part of what they were looking at was the Neighbourhood Partnerships Programme, which meant as many decisions that we can take at a local level should be taken at a local level. And that I found quite inspiring. I hadn't really considered myself a Liberal Democrat before that, to be honest. But
so where have you come from to this? I mean, do you have a day job, and what's your background?
Came to Bristol as a student in the late 90s. Worked in a lot of pubs and clubs, which is one of the reasons I went for the licensing thing.
Studying what?
Originally studying law at the UWE, and then did a second degree in politics at UWE. Moved across to Bristol and did my master's a few years ago.
Okay, well, thanks, Guy, who is Lochlea's councillor for the Liberal Democrat Party. Now, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Martin, King Mervyn, more tough talk this week from the Bank of England governor. The Treasury Select Committee on Tuesday, he talked about standards in Britain never recovering. He also said, why aren't the people angrier?
I think it's very interesting. I mean, we've had monetary reformers on this show, as you know, in previous weeks, and Mervyn King was actually saying, we don't actually believe in fractional reserve banking, which is a very big thing for the governor of the Bank of England to say. And also what he said this week about how it's the ordinary people who are going to pay the price, but it's actually the City of London that's responsible. I'm not quite sure what I think about Mervyn King, actually, because he's been a bit pro-cuts.
But, I mean,
on the other hand, I mean, I want to see the governor of the Bank of England, you know, dishing out a few punishments.
Yes, but he doesn't look like he's going to be doing that. Why do you think he's saying that standards may never recover? Is he saying that actually the extent to which this depression is going down, it does look like a double dip, certainly from the latest figures, that it's actually going to keep going down and it's never going to get back up to where it was before?
Well, indeed. And of course, if we have a double dip recession, the deficit will get bigger. By August, it's going to be quite clear that the deficit is bigger, not smaller. And at that point, this coalition government is going to collapse, just like the Irish coalition government or the Greek coalition government. There's going to be a big fight.
Guy, can I just ask you what you think about that? Do you think it's really that's likely if the economy really does sort of hit the wall at the end of the cul-de-sac?
I am no, you know, Oxford trained economist. It's a very difficult situation. I mean, the economic situation that was inherited by this government was something no government of any stripe would ever wish to inherit. We have to take a really serious approach to this, and really, really tough choices have needed to be made, and they have. It's a case of seeing what happens next to an extent.
Can I just cut in there, Tony? I think what we really need is a serious discussion about the situation we're in, not a Punch and Judy fight about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well,
let's
I mean, isn't that what Mervyn King is trying to provoke?
That's
here?
Exactly what the governor of the Bank of England is trying to do.
He's being about pretty much as radical as he can, really, by saying, "Look, standards may never recover." That's quite a strong thing to say.
There's an awful lot of fraud gone on during the savings and loans scandal in the 1980s, when the CIA were running drug money through the banks, the savings and loans business. 1,500 top executives in the US were sent to prison. Nobody's been sent to prison so far in this crash. And it's actually about fraud, a lot of this. Goldman Sachs are fraudsters. And you know, it may sound as if this is not what the people in Lochlea's talk about, yeah? But we need to have a serious discussion about the economy, which isn't, as I say, Punch and Judy. Let's have a chat. A serious chat about where we're going.
Well, one of the things you said at the start there, Martin, was that the Governor of the Bank of England has come out against fractional reserve banking. But, of course, most people, they just think, what is he talking about?
What is fractional reserve banking?
Yeah, what's the difference between ordinary banking and fractional reserve banking?
Well, fractional reserve banking is basically banking as we understand it. You lend out... Banks basically print money. The private sector banks create the money supply. So you think back to the 80s, where we're talking about the government controlling the money supply, monetarism. The reality is that the private sector creates the money supply for its own purposes. And that's the reality. And then we run a bubble and then it crashes. Yeah. But I was talking to you earlier before we started this show about the Liberal Party's fantastic tradition of economic literacy. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Keynes and so on. Mm. Yeah.
I mean, you know, surely Keynes would say right now we should be spending more, otherwise we're in danger of doing what Mervyn King's saying here, which is that the standards may never recover.
We're putting you on the spot.
You are, to some extent. Fractional reserve banking sounds to me like when the banks are lending far more than they're keeping
that's
back.
Right, yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, well, I mean,
the
reality is that that's what they do. But they used leverage is what they say. Leverage used to be about one. They used to lend £10 for every pound that they used to have. It's now 40, 50. Yeah.
So
the leverage has got completely out of control.
So what Martin's saying is the leverage, or as they say in the States, or leverage, is the amount of money that the banks are lending out compared to what they've actually got in deposits. So they lend out a lot more than they've actually got in deposits. So, yes. Of course, well, it's one of the reasons that if there was a run on the bank, not everybody would be able to actually get their money out because money isn't in there.
It's all. I mean, in the past, the Liberal Party, Keynes and others were... I mean, Keynes was such a clever guy. He ran the whole of the British government's economic policy in World War One and World War Two. He was just, you know, leave it to Keynes. He knows.
Anyway, one solution might be a Bank of Bristol, where we can print our own money, which we talked to John Rogers about a few weeks ago, and he said that it might be a possibility. But at the end of the day, we can't be totally dependent on the city, because it's like they're holding a gun against our heads saying, hang on, guys, we just want more and more money from the system and less for public services. So, I mean, I just wonder, Guy, what your thoughts are about this, and do you think that it's actually going to mean ultimately a rift between the Liberals and the Conservatives? Do the Conservatives absolutely stick to this policy of cut, cut, cut?
We hope so.
There have definitely got to be red lines, but I mean, this is stuff that the senior leadership of the party looks at and makes judgments about. I'm a local councillor. I deal with potholes. I realise these issues affect my constituents to a massive extent, but really there are people focusing on this full time. That's okay. Not what I do.
Well, let's move on to a local story then, which hopefully you'll be a little bit more au fait with.
Sure.
And that is the controversial Ashtongate Sainsbury's plan got the go ahead this week. Supermarket group Sainsbury's gained planning permission for its controversial Ashtongate development. Planners had recommended the scheme for refusal because of the negative impact it would have on local traders. But on Wednesday night, councillors deliberated for 3.5 hours before going against this advice and giving the scheme the nod. Now, I understand that you were on that committee, Guy. So could you just give us an idea of the sort of arguments which tipped the scales one way or the other?
I mean, obviously there are a lot of, as the officers acknowledged in their report, there are a lot of very finely balanced arguments either way. The issue of transport along Winterstoke Road was a very big issue that we spent a lot of time considering. Obviously the reason that they were recommending that we refuse the scheme was that they felt that the view of the impact on North Street was, you know, significant. Also, we had to, or it was recommended to us, and for legal reasons it had to be the case, we give very limited weight to Mr. Lansdowne's and the football club's argument that this was an enabling development that would allow Bristol to get its stadium. The thing that tipped the balance for me in the end, I suppose, was the idea that there will be more jobs at the end of this than there were before. We're in the pit of a recession. I certainly hope not a double dip. I don't think it will be a double dip, but we need to create some jobs. And Sainsbury's were offering a £20 million investment in South Bristol, which is an area in dire need of regeneration.
But what about those people on North Street who are going to be saying, hang on, this is just basically going to be the end for our business? And this is local people, local businesses and local jobs, and the money's been staying in Bristol. Sainsbury's is going to be sucking the money out of the city.
Well, we had representatives for the businesses, local business and of local people, speaking to both sides of it. I mean, we had local businesses speaking in favour of the Sainsbury's. There was a suggestion that having a Sainsbury's that close by would bring people into the area who would use the other shops as well. Now, again, that there are counter arguments to that. It's a very, very finely balanced issue. But at the end of the day, we came to the decision. I have to admit, the thing that changed my mind more than anything else was a young man who was a Sainsbury's employee, who I think was the fourth or fifth person who spoke to us in favour of the new Sainsbury's, who took us through what being able to get this job had meant for him and had meant for his sort of educational prospects in his life. And I have to admit, for all the, you know, Colin Sextons and Steve Lansdowne's and the lawyers of this world, that was the thing that really tipped me as much as anything else.
So I take it you voted for it.
I did.
Now, why was there a big swap around on the committee? Because it does, I mean, it, as an outsider looking in, it looks like a total fix-up. The whole committee changes just, you know, before this decision takes place.
I mean, you've got to remember, this was a different committee, but it was an entirely different application.
Well, because there had been a previous Sainsbury's application, which was quite similar on the site. I mean, you know, it does make me wonder. I mean, first of all, maybe you could just ask that question, why it was felt necessary to swap all the councillors on the committee around beforehand.
The reason, I mean, I got the phone call sometime over the weekend saying, look, if we're gonna swap people on this committee, would you be prepared to do it? Because of I think what my colleague Mark Bailey described as unfair vilification. A lot was thrown at the previous members of that committee that had voted to refuse the application.
What, by Bristol City Football Club?
I wouldn't want to hold Bristol City Football Club and or the Evening Post, you know, responsible for this. Their reporters, they do their job, and the City Club obviously is going to fight its own corner. That said, when emotions are running that high, you will always get people who go too far, and that happened to some of my colleagues. And it was felt that given what had happened following the last application, that it would just, if I was a resident of North Street and that had gone through with those councillors, I think I would be concerned that the fear of what might happen to them afterwards was weighing in their mind more than what, you know, the evidence that they should be taking into account.
Well, a cynic would say, I mean, call me a cynic if you want, they would say that, oh, well, the last lot said no, so we need a new lot who might say yes.
No, honestly, it really doesn't work that way. It's
Martin, do you want to just come in?
Well,
here?
This is all very technical stuff, and he's putting you through your paces. And all I can say is I don't really understand. These decisions are very complicated, and I listen to what you say.
But Martin, what about this whole issue of a giant soup? I mean, if you go down to Shepton Mallet, for example, you'll see where they had a giant Tesco store. Martin, would you be quiet and just listen for a second? Where they have a big Tesco store, the entire centre of Shepton Mallet is now closed, dead, empty shops, because the Tesco's, what they do in these big supermarkets is they suck out a lot of the retail spending from the local community and then just suck it into the retail park.
Well, I mean, you'll understand that I'm anti-supermarket. Of course I am. But I'm not in the position that you're in, making a decision with all of the implications that there are. And it's very easy for me to say, as somebody who's not elected to anything, that I don't agree with your decision. I hear what you say, which is you're taking into account everybody's point of view. And I'm anti-supermarket. I like local shops, don't you?
Now,
I'm a big fan of local shops.
Monopoly laws went out of the window this week, and ITN's looking a little more fragile this week as Conservative Culture Minister Jeremy Hunt approved Rupert Murdoch's bid to buy up the remaining shares in B Sky B. Hunt snatched control of the decision from Lib Dems Business Secretary Vince Cable after a Daily Telegraph sting operation in Vince's confidential MP's constituency surgery revealed that Vince Cable said he was at war with the Murdoch empire. So, even more control of our news outlets is a nice reward for News Corp, you might say, for all those calls to vote Tory from The Times, The Sun, The News of the World, and arguably Sky too, during last year's general election campaign. So, who's in charge of this country? Is it the politicians or Rupert Murdoch and the media barons? Former chairman of Sky TV, when it was launched, Andrew Neil, was on the BBC this week, giving his view of the takeover, which has now got the green light.
Let's not underestimate Rupert Murdoch. If he had one, would have sold his granny to get the rest of B Sky B. It's worth billions to his balance sheet. So if he has to warehouse or spin off Sky News for a period, he's happy to do that.
For a period?
Well, because I don't think it's clear that this would be forever. At some stage, this could easily come back. You know, I always smile when I see arrangements that governments put in place that there will be independent directors in charge of things that Mr. Murdoch has. I mean, you've just come off an item at the back of the news there on killer whales. It's pretty good move to go from that to what we're talking about now. We've seen it at the Times where the independent directors have never exercised their independence, and we've seen it more recently when he bought the Wall Street Journal, when the independent directors turned out there to be wholly useless. So this gets him through a difficult period. It is not the end of Rupert Murdoch's connection with Sky News. It's taken Britain a long while to get to three major news providers, and we now have that with the BBC, ITN, / ITV, and Sky News. What the politicians here have to realize is, when it comes to doing deals, Mr. Murdoch is an Italian. The real negotiations begin after you've signed the deal. And this is so complicated, there is scope for endless negotiation and ways of getting his way in the end, even after the politicians think the deal is done and dusted.
So, Guy Portney, who's Lib Dem councillor for Lockleys, what are your thoughts on this deal? Because actually what's happened here is the Lib Dem party and Vince Cable and his decision has been just sort of elbowed out of the way here, and the deal's been done between the Conservatives and Rupert Murdoch.
I think given the comments that Vince Cable made, there was no choice but to remove him from making that decision. What he said amounted to predetermination. His mind was made up effectively at that point.
But he's saying there's war with Rupert Murdoch, but that doesn't necessarily imply that that's the government that started that war, does it?
I mean, Rupert Murdoch's a very controversial figure. I mean, certainly in Australian and American media. If one of the things that might come out of this is that Britain is spared having a Fox News of all of its very own in the shape of Sky News, and certainly wouldn't want any of our major news providers to go in that direction.
So do you take seriously Rupert Murdoch's guarantee of independence for Sky News? Because former chairman of News, of Sky, Andrew Neil there, doesn't seem to think so.
Honestly, I don't know. Okay. I'm not ashamed to say.
Martin, and what do you think the implications of this? Is it, because Rupert Murdoch's really expanding his control of news, isn't he?
I think it was Lance Price, who was an advisor, he said there's a 13th member of the cabinet, and that is Rupert Murdoch. And that's how it was under New Labour. Now, like Berlusconi or Maldonado in Brazil or Berezovsky in Russia, these big, powerful media barons are the new overmighty subjects, and somebody's got to bring them down. If we don't do it, you've got to do it.
Well, Vince was going to do it, it seemed like,
No, I see. I think that was a setup. They sent a couple of pretty young girls to taste him up
into his confidential surgery with his constituents.
Yes, indeed. And it's that's the kind of world we're in now, where a serious politician like Vince Cable can be messed around with by these people. That's the problem.
Okay, on to our next story. And Bristol Cars, we hear, has gone into administration. Hand-built luxury cars since 1946. At the end of the Second World War, the Bristol Aeroplane Company decided it wanted to stop making fighter planes and bombers and make motor cars. But we hear just yesterday that it's gone into administration. Now, one of the things we keep hearing, Guy, is that the private sector jobs are going to get us out of this recession, even though there's 500,000 public sector jobs going to go. And this seems to be an indication in the opposite direction to that. So what are your thoughts about the end for Bristol Cars?
It's a tragedy. They made what looked to me like fantastic cars. I don't drive, but genuinely, work of art. One of the things I think you've got to bear in mind in that particular part of the... Well, it's not really technically within the Bristol boundary, but that bit of Filton, is you've got such a phenomenal concentration of the aerospace industry. I mean, on a national, international, it's a global recognition for that part of Bristol. I think making sure that industry continues to go from strength to strength in terms of producing new, greener aircraft is very important, both the city and the country.
Well, I mean, obviously, we need an industrial policy. We need to start thinking about where we want to go in terms of, say, the green future. Mm. We need to have a plan. I mean, well, cars, there's nothing wrong with having a plan. Martin, the market's all very well, but we need a plan.
Luxury cars are not a green future, are they?
Well, planned luxury cars for some people can be part of the plan, of course.
So do you think that this is an indication that the private sector really isn't up to the job of creating jobs?
Well, I mean, the reality is they're saying they're going to lose 500,000 jobs in the public sector and 600,000 in the private sector, according to the figures that the government are telling us. But, of course, this is before we have a war in Algeria or a collapse of the banks or Ireland refusing to pay. And before the year is out, we're going to be in deep, deep doo-doo. And then we need to have a serious discussion. Yeah, we're not making cheap points.
I wonder if, Martin, if you're scaremongering here, because you were saying a similar thing last year.
No. Can't people see how bad this is? The private sector banking system is bust. absolutely bust.
Okay, on to NHS reforms, and GPs may be paid bonuses to hold back care, claims the British Medical Association. GPs could receive bonuses for denying patients treatment under a shake-up of the NHS, a doctor's leader has claimed. Dr. Lawrence Buckman of the British Medical Association said such a scheme could be disgracefully unethical because it could set doctors lining their pockets while patients lose out. Now, we had Dr. John Rogers on, who's in the Lib Dem cabinet guy, a few weeks ago, singing the praises of these NHS reforms, but it seems the BMA are having second thoughts.
This looks to me, I've just seen this story for the first time, this looks to me like the law of unintended consequences. This reminds me more than anything else, to be honest, of when we had a situation where the government promised to cut the amount of time between your first calling a doctor's surgery and when you'd get your appointment, and the result was a lot of doctor's surgeries started saying we won't give you an appointment at all unless we can provide it in 24 hours. This strikes me as the law of unintended consequences. It might be something that needs a very simple fix.
Martin?
Well, I think when Dr. John Rogers was on here the other week, he didn't seem to understand that the NHS reforms will open up the NHS in Britain to European competition law. We've had an internal market up to now, but once you open it to an external market, he seemed to think that he will be able to buy stuff from his local hospital, and if that's what he wants, he can get it. But they're going to be sued through the courts. Yeah, we're opening up a whole business here.
Another revelation was in the Mirror the last couple of days. Apparently nearly nine out of 10 doctors think increasing competition in the NHS will lead to services being fragmented, a poll has shown. And 65% of doctors who responded believe competition between providers, including the NHS and private companies, will actually reduce the quality of patient care, while 61% think that the government's reforms mean they will spend less time with patients. Well, it's not exactly a ringing endorsement, guy, is it?
No, again, it's a story I've just seen. I mean, my feeling is our NHS is a probably, if I can say such a thing, the greatest thing that the Labour Party have ever done.
Absolutely.
For us as a country.
Well, you're now part of privatising it.
I don't know if I characterise it as privatisation. I mean, at the end of the day, if it's medical service free at the point of delivery, that's what I want for my constituents. I want, if they've got a medical problem, I want them to get treated as soon as possible in a clean hospital.
But the doctors here are saying, as I just said there, that they believe that a majority of doctors who responded to this survey believe the quality of patient care will be reduced and that they will be able to spend less time with patients.
Again, Dr. John Rogers knows a lot more about this than I do.
No, he doesn't.
Martin, would you like to just respond to that survey?
Yeah, I think this is where we have to get down to brass tacks. There is a case for planning. Why have we got private sector drug companies which rip off the NHS? We need to nationalise the drugs industry. This sounds very scary, doesn't it? Scary stuff. But we've nationalised the banking system. We've already done that.
We have nationalised part of it.
Yeah. No, we've nationalised it, but we're not actually asserting ourselves. It's about time to assert ourselves.
We haven't nationalised Barclays at all. Yes, we
have, because their deposits depend upon all the other banks that owe them money. And the whole system has been propped up by the taxpayer. I mean, as Mervyn King said to the House of Commons last week, The ordinary people are paying the price, and it's the City of London that's responsible for the mess. And we look to the Liberal Party, who are part of the government, to stand up for the ordinary people. Yeah, we look to you to do that.
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of being in the coalition, is to make absolutely sure that the worst of the Tory excesses would be curbed.
But we understand that.
Now, next story, a secret £600 million South West One deal is to be renegotiated, a controversial £600 million contract to outsource Somerset Council jobs to a private company is being renegotiated. Now, this is part of a deal which is also included with the police civilian support services in Avon and Somerset Police. Critics have claimed the deal is secretive and not open to scrutiny. In a report, the County Council said that the renegotiation would be led by a secret panel of councillors, which would include Conservative and opposition Lib Dem councillors. The actual details will be confidential because the council said it did not want to compromise its commercial interests and, by extension, the interests interests of Somerset's taxpayers. Now, Guy, this is a peculiar sort of deal, the sort of privatisation of civilian support services in the police and also parts of the administration of Somerset County Council. The big question here is, why is it so secret? I mean, does it make sense to do these privatisations when we're told you're not allowed to know, it's commercially confidential?
I mean, all councils are subject to freedom of information requests. I've not heard anything about this deal before. If there are commercially sensitive aspects to the deal, I can understand why they might hold information back, but I would expect due process to be followed all the way along. But it's a Somerset County Council issue.
But it's also even Somerset Police. All of their basically civilian support services are part of this deal. Things like the payroll, expenses for the police, this kind of thing, are all run on this computer system called SAP, or SAP, which we've heard several times is an absolute nightmare to deal with, and they're now tied into this deal.
I've never heard of it.
Okay.
I don't know.
Martin, we've had this story before.
Nor have I heard of it. This is really technical stuff, Tony. You've flummoxed us here.
Well, would you like to just talk about the idea of privatising parts of the local councils
look at the private finance initiative when Gordon Brown was the Prime Minister. The whole thing of the Jubilee line on the underground, that was done through private finance. It cost the taxpayer a fortune. And it's about time. There are many decent Conservatives who don't believe that the public should be ripped off by the private sector.
I'd agree with that completely.
Absolutely.
Well, as an adjunct to this, back in 2007, Avon and Somerset's Chief Constable Colin Port's wife Sue was paid hundreds of thousands of pounds under her maiden name Barnes to project manage this deal, the Southwest One and IBM privatisation. Port was called corrupt in the House of Commons by Bridgewater MP Ian Liddell Granger. And Colin Port complained to BCFM's station management that I called him corrupt but did not give him a right to reply, which is understandable. So I invited Colin Port onto this show to discuss it, but he declined. Here's what his staff officer John Riley replied. I'm writing on behalf of the Chief Constable further to your correspondence and my subsequent telephone call concerning your request for an interview with Mr. Port. I regret to inform you that Mr. Port is not able to assist you with your request. And IBM, let's not forget, leased computers to the Gestapo during World War II, as described in a book called IBM and the Holocaust by Edwin Black. Of course, it's a long time since then, but I think there's still many questions about this deal. Now, Lockheed Martin's big purple bus stopped in Bristol last week for 2011 census. What are your thoughts about the census, Guy? Are you going to be happily filling in those forms?
Honestly, I've not thought about it. The census bus is Lockheed Martin. The arms manufacturer.
Lockheed Martin is the company that's being commissioned to actually conduct the census in Britain this year. Lockheed Martin, which is a US arms firm, seems quite. Martin, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's rather odd, isn't it? Rather odd. I mean, you're surprised, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
You should be surprised. And that's how far things have gone. That our census to try and find out what the hell's going on is being run by some private American company.
I should clarify, if a private company can deliver the census at better value for money than the government can do it, then...
But you are surprised, aren't you?
I'm surprised. My main association with Lockheed Martin is that it's probably, I don't know the same as yours, from the film Bowling for Columbine.
Yeah.
So what is that? Can you just explain that reference?
The major arms manufacturer for the American military. I mean,
but what's happening now, you see about the health service reforms, once you mess the divide between public and private, then you get into real problems. And public sector stuff, you see, I used to work in social economy, and people used to talk about creating, you know, third sector organisations. And the real problem, I used to work for the council, and one of the real problems is that there are fiduciary responsibilities on public sector organisations. You cannot subcontract this to a private organisation. You cannot. And we were trying very hard. We were New Labour social economy people. But the financial people would come back to us and say, yeah, but the problem with this is it's against British common law. Public money cannot just be subcontracted to whoever.
Well, we'll see about that. Anyway, just to put the question again, do you think this is actually wise to have a US arms manufacturer? I mean, for example, I can remember back in 1975, Lockheed were involved in a massive scandal, the Lockheed bribery scandal, where the Dutch royal family had been bribed $1 million to buy Lockheed jets. And actually, these jets just fell out of the sky, the starfighters. Are these the kind of people that should be running our census?
I don't know if it's the same people running the company now. I have absolutely
no idea.
Almost
certainly different directors, but the same firm.
You're throwing things at him that he doesn't. You know, isn't it odd though?
It sounds odd the way that you've placed it. I think my constituents would be upset if they thought I was dealing with this sort of stuff rather than things that are affecting them on a very daily basis. At the end of the day, we need the census done.
Yes, okay. We do.
Now, Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week, and she's been asking a question. Who is responsible for the financial crisis? Is it the banks, or is it Blair and Brown and the previous Labour government?
Is the current financial crisis the result of the last Labour government's overspending, or of an international banking crisis?
The easiest thing to say is the last Labour government, but I think they did make a lot of mistakes. But there's always outside pressures as well from other countries. I think a lot of it is down to Labour government's outlook on life and not keeping control of their spending.
I think it's probably more of a long-term issue over the last 30 years where they've got away with a lot of risks they shouldn't have taken. It's only recently come back to haunt them, and I don't think you can hold it down to one administration.
I think it's this international banking crisis, so it's not because the government, it was because the whole situation in the world.
I think it's more international than anything to do with the Labour government.
Who should be blamed for the crisis?
Probably the same people as always have, the middle classes, because the rich will find ways of getting around it, and the ones that are on social security or benefits still get those regardless. It's the vast majority of people wage earning and trying to pay their taxes that will once again pay it.
Probably the FSA, because it's not regulated properly, the government for not tightening up, and for the banks just taking silly risks. Yeah, all three.
Of course, banks, yeah. All the banks, yeah, that's what I think.
The banks.
What do you think about the cuts?
Cuts have got to come. I'm not saying that I agree necessarily with the way that they're some of them are. It's like anybody, if they haven't got the money, you can't spend. And in the hope that in two or three years' time we might have get back to a more normal situation, we have to cut at the moment, same as everyone does. Well, as I just said, you need the cuts. Tax rises, I think, will come, but nobody likes to sort of put it up. But there's lots of ways, like the last government had, of raising taxes without necessarily putting it on the PAY system.
Well, the cuts are necessary to stabilise the financial climate, so I think people always prefer cuts before tax rises, but then again, it all depends which services get impacted first.
Fortunately, I don't take any benefits, so for me it's nothing really bad, so I don't feel anything about these cuts. Fortunately, the tax rises is not the best thing, so I don't like that.
I think they're necessary evil.
Is it right to increase the tax on banks?
Once again, it'd be the people in the middle, the middle classes, that would pay it, because the ones that have got bank accounts will pay it in charges anyway. Although they say that they are going to tax the banks, who owns the banks and who are the people that put the money into the banks? So that's where the money's going to come from.
Yes, obviously it's right to tax the banks because it was their fault.
I don't know, really, it's not my thing, I think. Probably banks.
Yes, definitely.
There we are. That's talking and thinking about who's responsible for the financial crisis. Is it New Labour and the previous government, or is it the banks? Now, Guy Portney, who's Lib Dem councillor for Lochlea's, what are your thoughts on this one?
Personally, banks will do what banks do. Banks are out there to make money. It was a government's job to regulate these better. And I'm not just talking about our government. Global governments needed to do more to regulate the banks. What Gordon Brown did was deprive us of our ability to respond effectively to it when it came along.
Okay, Marina Morris, what have you got for us?
A report from the Rare Cancer Foundation states that GPs are failing to recognise 1 in 4 cancer cases. The resulting delays are contributing to the UK's high cancer death rate. 2/3 of those diagnosed this rare cancer experience a potentially fatal wait of 3 months in between making an appointment to see their GP and being told they have cancer. According to a study published in the British Journal of General Practice, some symptoms need urgent investigation. These are rectal bleeding, low red blood cells due to lack of iron, abnormal results from rectal examination, blood in the urine, coughing up blood, breast lump, and difficult swallowing. If tests come back negatively and you will feel something is wrong, you can ask your GP to tell you exactly what investigations were done. You can ask for a second opinion at your surgery or for a referral to a specialist. And if you are unhappy with your GP, you're entitled to move surgery. Dr. Martin Scaff, chairman of the Independence Doctors Forum, believes that early warning symptoms are too frequently being dismissed as a minor ailments, whilst many wait so long for diagnosis that it comes too late. He fears the change in NHS funding models, putting GP in charge of most of the budgets, could make things even worse. The doctor who orders the scans and tests is going to have to pay for them out of his budget. He will be under pressure to cut costs. So, will he send you for expensive tests or try to a cheap alternative for other possible explanation of the symptom first, at the expense of a possible fatal delay in the worst-case scenario? With just 10 minutes to spend with each patient, it is very difficult to always get right things, especially this rare cancer. Doctors are trained to make diagnoses founded upon experience-based instincts, which could be described as educated guesswork. A criticism often leveled at private GP that they over-investigate, and perhaps there is a risk of investigating too much when the more tests, the bigger the fee. But perhaps it is better to over-investigate than to misdiagnose. Misdiagnosis is much worse things for a patient to die this and a GP to have to live this.
Well, I suppose the thanks, Marina. I suppose the most important implication here that Marina's talking about is that it does look, Guy, as if with the new changes, especially certainly the doctors are saying, that there may be simply less time to spend with patients and that things may not get diagnosed properly as a result.
Well, for one, I don't think GPs necessarily make... Well, I don't think they make decisions based on money unless they absolutely have to. At the end of the day, a GP signs the Hippocratic Oath.
This is about time. This is about how much time a doctor can spend with the patient.
If I went to my doctor with one of those symptoms, I would want to be tested as soon as humanly possible, and if I didn't get that from my GP, I would go to a different GP.
I think one of the things that people don't realise is that the British National Health Service, which you were praising earlier, is simply, it's not the best in the world, but by God, it's the cheapest. We spend a fraction of what the French and the Germans spend, and we've nearly got the same outcomes. Because planning, not the market, is actually the way to go, which is what Nye Bevan understood in 1945. You can't... All this stuff about the market, that's old hat. It's old hat. What we really need to do is nationalise the drugs production industry, as well as the National Health Service. Now, I can see you frowning, because you're still in market think. And what I want to say to you is the private banking system is bust. There is a case for economic planning. Keynes understood that case, and many other... Lord George understood that case. Do you understand it?
Economic planning is one thing. State-directed industry is quite another.
Well, but we're now... Yes, but what's state-directed into? But people talk about China, for example, has got an 8% growth rate. It's run by a communist party, which has got lots of state industries. Now, are they rubbish or are we rubbish?
Where would you rather live?
I'd rather live here, with talking to you like this.
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Which you couldn't do in China, Mark.
Which we couldn't do.
Right, next story. Buying a house is now cheaper. And although this is a national story, Guy, I'm sure people in Lockleys are rather concerned about this one. Buying a house is now cheaper than renting as property prices fall. At least according to the Daily Mail it is. Falling house prices and rising rents have made it cheaper to buy a home than to be a tenant in 8 out of 10 towns. Renting a home now costs an average of 10.5% more than paying interest on a mortgage for a comparable property, up from a premium of 8.7% in the middle of last year, according to property website zoopla.co.uk. Now, this, on the surface of it anyway, just seems like another example of how the LibCon Alliance and the policies that they're bringing in is actually really beating up the poor and favouring the rich.
I can well imagine mortgage payments being lower than renting, that's presuming that you've got the 20% deposit to put in it in the first place. This is one of the reasons I'm still renting where I live.
It might help if I just go through some of the particular things that the surveys found out. Monthly rents are higher than mortgage payments in 8 out of 10 towns. We also found out average of two-bedroom house in Milton Keynes costs £785 a month to rent, but £550 a month to buy. Mortgage repayments for typical first-time buyers in Walsall can be 38% cheaper than monthly rents, and rents exceeding mortgage costs by an average of 20% in 14 of the biggest cities across Britain. So this is not just a sort of a little litmus test in one or two towns that happens to have gone one way. This is a big survey, and we're hearing the 14 biggest cities of all, this is the case in all of them.
Certainly feels like the case in Bristol as well, to an extent. I mean, one of the reasons I ended up living in Lockleys in the first place was that I can rent a house, a three-bedroom house in Lockleys, for less money than it costs to get a single-bedroom flat in Horfield. That's the nature of the beast. One of the things I find most difficult most frequently, though, I have to admit, is that the standards of house building in terms of minimum spacing requirements and those sorts of things have ended up pricing a lot of people out of both the buy and the rental markets.
So what happens today? Are they homeless or what?
You end up going in on a house with a bunch of other people and living in a house in multiple occupation.
What about your thoughts on this survey, Martin?
Well, what I would like to say is Ed Balls, the new shadow chancellor in the Labour leadership election, he spoke outside the box and he said maybe what we need in this country is a whole new generation of council housing. And they were told, "Oh, shut up!" Now, "Oh, shut up!" But we're going there. What happened in the past? And Liberal governments and Conservative governments. Do you know who built the most council houses? It was Harold Macmillan, the Conservative government. And what you do when you build council houses is you knock all this property bubble stuff on the head.
But Martin, this is pie in the sky. There's no money for building council houses.
No. We've got to reflate the economy. How are we going to do that? There's loads of building workers are out of work. We're going to build some council houses. We're going to start talking like this. That's how they used to talk in the 1940s. We're going to build some council houses.
I'll tell you what, I was gutted. I was absolutely gutted because we very nearly had new council houses going up in my ward and they are badly needed.
We've got some coming in the city, haven't we?
We have,
for the very first time.
Alas,
praise be, glory be, you know.
Yeah, it is happening.
I think these are the ones in Lockleys. Are you telling us now that that's not happening?
Last time I checked, the project was on indefinite hold. I don't hold out high hopes for
this.
This
was around
back,
about the time of the last election. This was being talked about.
It's less than a year ago.
So it doesn't look like this is happening, Martin.
It will happen because we're going to have a bigger deficit and the economy is going to have a double dip and then we're going to start talking seriously.
But as the deficit gets bigger and bigger, so the government's got less and less power
to
spend.
We've got to have fiscal consolidation and that means that we've got to have an honest discussion with the wealthy classes in this country. You Liberals and us Labour people and the Scottish Nationalists, Sinn Féin, we've got to have a word with the right wing of the Tory party. The left wing of the Tory party understand what I'm talking about. We've got a national coalition.
What is this fiscal consolidation you keep talking about? It's a bit of a jargonistic.
Well, what I mean by this, we can't just spend our way out. We were talking about Keynes earlier. We can't just spend our way out. Of course, we can actually spend more than we earn, which is all this stuff about we've maxed out our credit card. That's economic illiteracy. Of course we can spend. You know, a country can spend more than it earns. That's what A-level economics is all about. But of course, you can't just spend. There's got to be an honest discussion with everybody in the society. And when we've got people like Lord Ashcroft, who hasn't paid a penny of tax in this country for 20 years, saying he's really upset because the boys haven't got any boots in Afghanistan, I just think that's a joke.
Okay, and now, you heard all about the protests in Libya, Egypt and Bahrain, but how about a 10-day-long occupation of the state legislature in Madison, Wisconsin, in the United States? Wisconsin's lawmakers are discussing changes that would see trade unions effectively banned from going on strike to defend wages and jobs. So now let's have a listen to a quick report on that.
All the people I grew up with in Milwaukee, more than half of them have public sector jobs. I'm tired of people pretending that there's somebody who's going to solve these problems for us.
The state capitol, where lawmakers were set to pass the controversial bill, has been stormed by protesters, spending days and nights here, eating, sleeping, and fighting back.
I mean, I voted for Obama, but I'm tired of Democrats turning their backs.
We've only heard him say one statement, really, on this matter. America's asking, why isn't Obama here? Why isn't the president getting more involved?
We're here because of Wall Street reckless gambling and greed, okay? That is why we're all here. People are suffering. President Obama will not win 2012 without states like Wisconsin, and he should be here standing with the workers.
Well, that's from Madison, Wisconsin. That's the state legislature, which has been occupied by union trade unionists and activists from across the state and other parts of America are flocking to there. Now, Martin, what does this tell us about, the possible, I suppose, future in this country?
Well, I mean, what's happening in the US is that people voted for Obama 2 years ago, whenever it was. I mean, many of the people would be similar to Labour or Liberal people here. He's been a big disappointment. Big disappointment. He hasn't done what he's supposed to do. But what's now happening, what the right-wing Tea Party governor, Scott something or other, that runs Wisconsin, is trying to withdraw all collective bargaining rights from the public sector trade unions, particularly the teachers. And the teachers and the firefighters have agreed a pay cut. They've agreed, they've played ball all the way, but we're not going to give up our right to collectively bargain. Yeah, the AFL-CIO only exists because we've got a right to collectively bargain. And hundreds of thousands of people have stormed the Capitol building in Madison, Wisconsin. And they are standing there firmly.
Hundreds of thousands of people can't fit in the Capitol building.
No, they can't. But the police were ordered to clear those people out 2 days ago. And the police came out and said, we've just been given an order to clear you people out. But well, we're the police and we're not doing it.
On that report I saw, there actually police were actually part of the protest. Anyway,
absolutely.
Guy, this is a bit worrying, isn't it? I mean, you think we're going to see the Bristol City Council House occupied if things get tough here?
I wouldn't have thought so. What policy is it that's actually being objected
to?
Well,
the policy that's being objected to is that the unions, the public sector unions in Wisconsin, have agreed to a pay cut. You know, they've negotiated pretty silly, really. Frankly, I don't agree with it.
Now, what's happened is, actually, Guy, is that they're thinking of bringing in a new law to actually stop unions, ban unions from forcing...
It's union busting.
Collective bargaining. So, in other words, if a union does go on strike through collective bargaining, then actually then they will be liable to arrest. So that's simply it.
I certainly don't think that the British government at the moment is considering the total prohibition of trade unions.
They are in the United States. That's where we're at.
Okay, our final story, electrification of Bristol to London. Some good news, I hope. It seems like good news on the surface. Transport Secretary Philip Hammond has announced the go-ahead for electrification of the Western Great Western Main Line. Journey times will be slashed and overcrowding eased after the government gave the go-ahead for electrification of the Great West Main Line. Passengers from Bristol to London will arrive 22 whole minutes earlier on cleaner, greener, larger trains. The Transport Secretary Philip Hammond has told the Evening Post. Four more trains will run between the cities every hour with twice as many seats. Now, good news?
Fantastic news. Any investment in our railways is hugely appreciated.
Martin?
I think we need to do more of this. This is exactly how we're going to get out of the crisis. Think of the things we need to do, cost it all up, and do it.
Well, there is the fact, though, that with electrification, there's actually a lot more maintenance on the track. So it's likely to be, because what happens is, you get wind and the wires kind of get, don't lose contact or whatever. So actually, it means that it's going to force the fares up because of more maintenance. And it's a nice contract for somebody to look after these electric lines. So, I mean, what's the problem at the moment? I don't have any problem with getting on a diesel train. Why is an electric train so much better?
I don't have any problem with getting on a train that gets me there on time. There are going to be more of them because of this.
Martin.
In the 1980s in New Zealand, when the left wing of the Labour Party forced a PR referendum, one of the first things they did is they overturned what the right wing of the Labour Party had done, which is to privatise the railways. And they put the railways back in public ownership. Just like that. Southern Hemisphere rugby.
This isn't actually about privatisation. It's about electrification. But anyway, thanks to this week's guests, Lib Dem councillor for Lockleys, Guy Portney. After the news, the latest on our environment from Mike Birkin and Friends of the Earth in the Southwest. Plus, are we seeing democracy and revolution in Libya?
Or are these the opening shots in a world war? So, our aircraft carriers are gone. The Harriers and Nimrods have been scrapped as local MP and Conservative Defence Secretary Liam Fox announces the loss of 11,000 jobs from our armed forces. Martin Summers and I will explore the turmoil in Afghanistan, Pakistan, in the news in the Middle East. Coming up after the Sky News at 6 from Rupert Murdoch.
FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
CFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol